But it's an awesome disease. And after the symptom goes away, it's still awesome. And there comes a time where you stand in front of those issues, get to be where you get grown up enough. I got honest enough. I just couldn't lie to myself much more. You started to change me. You affected my level of self-honesty. I just couldn't deny it as much as I used to be able to. At 5 years of sobriety, my denial mechanisms were less effective than they were in certain areas of my life than they were when I was newly sober. And at some point in my time, I got to a point where I had to deal with it. And once I really started to deal with it, I dealt with it the same way. I had almost the same experience of surrender when I came into Alcoholics Anonymous. I stopped telling lies about it. And I surrendered and I started to say, okay, whatever it is, I'm going to do. When I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, I stopped telling lies about it. And I surrendered and I started to say, okay, whatever it is, I'm going to do. And how do you surrender? I mean, you run out of yourself. I mean, the reason that I didn't surrender is I still had one more idea. I still had one more thing to do. I still wanted to run Iraq. I did not want to do it. Whatever, I mean, I either wanted to keep doing what I was doing, or I wanted to not do what I was supposed to do. One of those two things. And I had to try everything I knew how to try. My commitment was to avoiding it. And hell, I'm not looking for surrender. I'm looking for control. I mean, the reason that we don't know how to surrender is it's not even on our list. I mean, it's nice because we're talking about it. But I mean, it doesn't even show up on our list. You want to know how to do it. It's just amazing. I mean, it is amazing. Let's have a coffee break. And it's chilly. Yeah. And if you think it's chilly here in Minnesota, there are people in the audience wearing blankets and jumped out of bed this morning and broke my pajamas. I mean, God, it was... that's all cold. When John asked me just before we closed the last session, you know, how do you surrender? And someone else, Roe or someone, was talking about we really hang on to our problem. I think we ought to know that our problems are generally not our problems. Our problems are our own solutions. The things that we call problems are things that we have put in place as stabilities in our lives to solve other problems. We don't view them as problems. We view them as answers. And that's the reason why primarily I think that we don't. So when many of us have spending money issues or gambling issues or sex issues or certain things like that, especially in the area of compulsive behaviors, those are answers to certain, you know, the certain issues in life, that certain realities we don't want to stand in front of, and those are escapes, and there are rewards that come out of that kind of behavior for us. There's consequences, but we're used to that pattern. Hell, there were rewards and consequences that came out of our drinking. You know, or pieces of it that worked real well and pieces of it that didn't work real well. And so we have exactly the same, those arenas of our lives that we often say, how do you get rid of this problem? I mean, all of us need to know that in most cases, it's an answer to a previous problem. And it's imperfect, but we're familiar with it, and we're really committed to it, and that it works at some level. We're still getting some stuff out of it that we don't want to give up. And some of that's, we're not aware of it, but there's a... there were very few of us are able to stand in front of our problem without some protection, without just bare naked, flat in front of the problem. Almost none of us ever were really able to freely stand in front of the question of whether we were an alcoholic. I mean, people could almost had to use a jackhammer to get that one in front of us. And we just avoided it at every expense. And I think that most of us avoid in a similar sort of way, standing in front of our issues. And as soon as we're able to say to ourselves, yeah, I've got a gambling problem, got a serious gambling problem, and I need to do something about that, and say that in a way that it isn't like a complaint, say it in a way that it's a real admission and acceptance, something shifts. And most of us don't, in the important areas of our lives, we don't go very public with it. We don't really have those kinds of conversations. We really don't have the we just don't go right at it. The other part of this powerlessness issue that I wanted to discuss or throw out one other idea is, of course, the problem with being powerless is if you're powerless, there better be a power. And if there is a power greater than ourselves, that in some cases creates as many issues as the concept of powerlessness. Because most of us have a lot of history with concepts of power greater than ourselves, a lot of history with God, a lot of history with religions, a lot of history with families, a lot of issues with authority. Okay, so we have all the societal sorts of things that tell you that, you know, if you're really going to make it in this world, I mean, you don't want to be a wimp. You know, I mean, if you're going to be in business today and you're going to be a professional, if you're going to be the kind of person we want around this company, you know, I mean, we don't want people who don't have power and authority and aggressiveness. I mean, those are talents that you need. And there's a lot of encouragement not to be how we sometimes have to be, and how we think we sometimes have to be, number one. Number two is that in order to have a God in our lives, most of us have a historic idea of a God that we don't trust. And I also suggest to us that we cannot have a relationship with, if we don't trust ourselves and we don't trust other people, you can't trust God. Just flat can't trust God. So our program works in the three areas of our lives, just like our AA program and the fifth step when we admit to God, ourselves, another human being. Every area of our life is broken down in relationship with God, in relationship with ourselves, and relationship with others. The steps are broken down in that same category. Life is broken down in that same category. And issues are broken down in that same category. So when you have trust issues, they're everywhere. And I think to really, the issues that is in the way of most of my spiritual growth is my relationship with my God has to do with issues of trust. And in order to trust God, in order to trust my higher power, I have had to increase my relationship with that higher power. When I came to AA, the relationship that I had and the concepts that I had of a God, I was about 14 or 15 years old chronologically or emotionally in that experience. I got to a point in my spiritual and religious background when I was 15 that I couldn't play the game by the rules anymore, and I dropped out. And not totally. I had this love-hate relationship, you know, with it all the way through. And when I showed up in AA, I mean, I was so uncomfortable listening to anything that sounded too spiritual. I used to literally switch meetings. We had an upstairs and downstairs, you know, meeting in our place. And if they got going too strong on something that I just literally almost couldn't stay in the room. I would often, you know, go downstairs and see how the other group was doing about that time, or get a cup of coffee, or, I mean, my blood pressure used to go up about 20 points just driving by a church. I mean, I had a lot of unfinished business, a lot of unresolved stuff. It was very important to me, and yet I felt like I had been, I could talk for hours on just the phoniness of what I thought was in the church, and yet I'm supposed to go back and try to find my answer, and I was angry about a whole bunch of stuff, and, you know, it was just all mismatch. And I found you people just loved me through every bit of that, and I found God through you people. I found God in your strength. I found God in the dignity of your lives. I found God, I mean, it was just so clear to me that, it's still clear to me. I mean, I am going through a difficult time in my business, and I'm in meetings all the time with people who have problems that are many times the size of my problems, that are have more dignity with the way they're going through them than I have. I mean, I just hate how I am when I'm hooked into my own problem. I mean, I just hate it. You know, I'm saying, God, you shouldn't be as upset as you are. I mean, you know, you're 22 years sober. Why the hell, I mean, don't you trust? Well, yeah, I trust Monday, Wednesdays, Fridays, Saturdays, and part of Sunday, but I got Tuesdays and Thursdays I just have a hell of a time with. I mean, there are just, I mean, you know, and when I get hooked into my issues, I mean, I'm ineffective. I mean, I'm just, it's just crazy. You know, and I know the answers. I mean, I could give a lecture on it. But the fact is when I'm in the presence of it, when I'm really, when my security is being threatened or my business is being threatened or I think the well-being of my family is being threatened, I mean, I'm not very objective about it. And there are, you know, so I going through all, you know, all the swings. And those are powerlessness issues. I want control, and I don't control it. And yet there's a hell of a lot of things that I'm in charge of and responsible for, I'm supposed to be doing day in and day out in the face of it. I don't think there's anybody in this room that isn't exactly in the same position I am. With their lives, with their families, with their business, I think that's always the issue. I think there are times when we feel more comfortable. I think there's times when we feel like we're more in control. And sometimes that's an accurate assessment, and sometimes it's just how we happen to feel at the time. And that's, you know, life's going, you know, we go through cycles. And in order to, I think, really, as time goes on, the issue of my relationship with my higher power is the central issue of my life. To the extent that I can rely and participate in that relationship, I can put these principles into operation in my life. And I can trust, and I'm, you know, when I'm in a good place, what I want to be is a pipe. I'm not the source. I'm the pipe. And that's what, when things really work in our lives in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, you're not the source, you're the pipe. The problem is when you're the source. Because when you're the source, you're going to run out of whatever you got quickly. And I really think that it's when the power works through us. And I think that one of the neatest example of that is for those of us who sponsor people, often you're having a conversation with someone and all of a sudden you tell that person something that you know is true and you know that you didn't know it. You, I mean, you have absolutely no idea where you got the piece of information that you gave to that person. I mean, you just, literally, no recollection, you didn't remember from anybody. I mean, it's just, there's something magical that happens in the process. And I think there's something magical that happens in rooms like this, in meetings like this. I think, collectively, you know, there's my experience of God. Most of the time, I experience God through you. I mean, I really think my relationship with you is mostly a spiritual relationship. I think when I'm with you, I know more about who I am and what I am. My identity, you know, I'm a more spiritual being. And there's no question about what my business is with you when I'm in a room with you. Okay? And when I'm in a business room, that's not always true. When I'm in a business room, sometimes I forget that I'm a spiritual being. I'm not supposed to talk to a room full of businessmen about Alcoholics Anonymous or, you know, spiritual principles, but I still am a spiritual person. Still, that is my business. It's still my main identity. But sometimes I forget that, and I get real threatened and real concerned about, you know, the stuff that I'm going through. But I am strengthened and reinforced by the kind of focus that AAs always bring to things. So when I go around, part of the reason that I'm willing to go around the country like this is I do it for 12-step work, but I do it because I meet the most active members of Alcoholics Anonymous all over the United States. And I am encouraged. When I go home, I'm more willing to practice my program than when I came. I mean, I have a level of enthusiasm. You know, I mean, I have a great group. I just love my group. But this is an aspect of Alcoholics Anonymous that I enjoy too. And I go back and I'm, you know, when I'm with 100 or so people or 500 or so people on a weekend, and when I get to sit down with a couple of other people that have been in the program a long time, and we sit down and we say, how's it working? Well, I'm saying, well, on issues 2, 3, 4, and 6, I'm doing okay. You know, and I'm a little bit stuck on issues 5 and 7, but I'm working on it, and I'm, you know, and we talk like, you know, like that. Like, that's the business. I mean, that's the, like, there's almost an obligation when you're with someone who you're kind of partners with. And that's what we are at some level, I think. We're kind of partners. Some of us are coaches. Some of us are, you know, I mean, but we're partners going through the deal. And part of the issue is when we sit down and talk, what we want to know about the business with each other is, how's your life? How's your life? Is there something I can do to add to your life? Is there some encouragement I can give you? Is there something we can do? And now, how's your life? I mean, isn't that almost what we're doing for each other and with each other in Al-Anon and in Alcoholics Anonymous? How's your life? And life shows up in the funniest places. I mean, you know, I mean, it is. It's almost as if, as we go through different periods of time, that like the pressure is put on it. When the pressure is increased, it's almost as if the water pressure increases, and we start to find out where the cracks are in the dam. It starts to leak out, and it isn't important. We give so much importance as to the peculiar problems that we have. There are people who have gambling problems that absolutely, and I think that they need to talk to someone who has a gambling problem to find an answer. And I'm not. This is not a diatribe on Gamblers Anonymous. I'm just. There are people who have financial problems that need to talk to someone who knows exactly that issue. You know how before we came to Alcoholics Anonymous, someone would have said, "Who do you want for a sponsor?" Well, I wanted someone who was 23 years old, who did what I did, or came from my neighborhood, or, you know, I wanted everything as similar as it could get. And what I got, you know, was a 50-year-old mailman who was an outdoorsman, a hunter, you know, who was as different as he could be. I mean, I wouldn't trade that man in. I mean, you know, because there's something about the differences that teaches you the similarities. There's something about, you know, when the plumber can teach the doctor, you know, the principle, he knows it's a principle. You know, when the doctor teaches the doctor a principle, sometimes it reinforces the, you know, the some of the weaknesses in the process too. But there's something that when there's two such different people, we know that the power isn't in either one of us. You know, the power is coming from someplace else, and we're just kind of passing it on. So we give encouragement in the circumstances that are showing up for each of us. If we went around this room and said, "What are you worried about?" You know, "God, my enemy business," or "my kids," or something. You know, and someone else's would be X and someone else's would be Y, and we'd have 15 different categories in the room. And the categories aren't very important. It just happens to be where life's showing up. And the wonder of it is that we can sit in meetings and we would talk about the principles. I mean, that's why we don't talk about problems in Alcoholics Anonymous. That's the most amazing thing in the world. We don't often talk about problems. And why, John, there's just confusion in problems. You just get bogged down in the peculiarities and the uniquenesses of the people and the players and the circumstances. And, you know, I mean, you get into a problem, you got yourself a black hole. No, but I mean, it is. You literally, I mean, that's what's happened to me. It hasn't happened to me in a long time, but I'm just amazed that I still have that same suck that I get inside of that. You become the problem. I mean, you don't have a problem. You are the problem. Okay? How are you? Oh, I'm a problem. You know. You literally becomes your identity. It becomes who you are and what you are. It is just you take it with you everywhere you go. You become the problem. When I'm an Alcoholics Anonymous, I have the best opportunity I've ever had in my life to become the answer. I mean, I just literally ignore the problem. I mean, you don't have a... When I first started going through this issue in my life, I had one particular partnership where I lost enough money to burn a wet elephant. I mean, I lost a lot of money. And, you know, no one cared. I mean, just no one gave a damn. And at first, I didn't discuss the peculiarities. I'd say, "How's it going?" "Oh, it's going bad and difficult." "Oh, tell me about it." Well, they got about a minute and a half that they're willing, you know. I mean, it's complex. I mean, I've got 2 hours that if you really want to know about the problem, it's going to take 2 hours. "Well, Bob, I got 3 or 4 minutes. Give me 3 or 4, you know. We don't have much time for the problem. I mean, it's wonderful, because what you learn is the problem is not important. I mean, I'm glad you don't have time for my problems. I would be inexhaustible if you had time for my problems. I mean, I could just do my problems forever. They've got my answers. But you have no time for my problems. You have just enough time. Okay? I've heard it. I care about it. I'm concerned about you. Now what?" "Well, let's talk about the problem." "I don't want to talk about the problem." "We're done with the problem." "Well, I'm not done. I mean, I'm not nearly done with this problem." "I will let you know when we're done." "I mean, you obviously don't get it. I mean, this is, there are this is a rich problem. I mean, this is not... I mean, if you are done with the problem, you do not have a big enough container. I mean, you just don't understand the issue. And I'm very glad that you share the solution to me, with me. I'm glad that at different periods of time, I love to watch golf tournaments. I've just become a golfer, really a golfer in the last couple of years. But I've watched golf tournaments all my life. My dad watched golf tournaments, and I got in the habit. The most relaxing thing in the world for me is to build a fire and turn on a golf tournament Sunday afternoon. God, when I do that, I mean, it's just wonderful. And sometimes my son comes in the room, and we just kind of loll around in the afternoon and big fire going and watch golf tournament. And these guys and gals are the best golfers in all the world. I mean, they are just awesome. And there's always... But what's interesting about it is there's always two or three or four people who kind of dominate during any given period of time. But you run into them at another period of time, and hell, they'll develop a difficulty, and it'll just destroy their game. I mean, they'll drop off that leaderboard, and you won't see them on the leaderboard for I don't know how long. Now, I think a little bit, if we were groups of alcohol, you know, kind of like professionals in the business of living our lives and using the 12 steps, if we were all like a golf tour, I mean, I think there's times when different one of us are kind of in the front of the troop and we're on a roll, you know, where we're just... Everything's working, we're in a groove, and we don't kind of know about it, and we're doing that. And I often rely, every once in a while I'll grab a hold of someone and I'll ask them to look at my putting stroke, you know, because I'm not on a roll. Something's going on with me in my life, and I need someone who's a pro, who's really committed to it, and that's kind of how we operate with each other in their lives. And the people who are, people give me some encouragement. I get encouragement from both the people who are doing it very well, and I get encouragement from the people who sometimes aren't doing it very well but are working at it. When they're out in the practice tee, you know, hitting 1,000 balls a day or something like that, there's something about that I think there's a lot of dignity in that. There's a lot of people who are dealing with issues, and the way they're engaged with them is an example for me. And so So we're getting back to the issue of powerlessness. If we're powerless and we need a power and we're not the source, we need a God. For most of us, the relationship we have with our God is insufficient. And most of us have a bargaining relationship with God. We have a historical relationship with God. We give him personalities and we don't trust him. Most of us start to learn about our God and reopen up the definition of that in Alcoholics Anonymous, and we watch it, we experience God through each other. Because that's what's working in these rooms. That's what the magic is. And then we start to rebuild almost like a consensus opinion of what a higher power is in our life. Bit by bit, we just kind of draw that from the different experiences that we have, and I think we reconstruct. We reconstruct the God of our very own understanding. It's like a changing sort of thing. And I want you to know that for me, that has been, I've had to widen my trust. I've had to widen my relationship with God, widen my definition of God, widen every aspect of it in order to continue to take on the things that come into my life. Because the barriers that I've run into in my life at a given time, the reason I'm not able to, I don't want to be in front of them, I don't want to deal with them, is I'm not big enough to deal with them. And it's almost as if up to that time, the relationship that I had with my higher power wasn't big enough for me. You know, and you notice even the way I talk wasn't big enough for me. You know, I mean, it's just so automatic, you know, that I'm going to go take it on. And so I think at any given point, maybe what we're able to do, maybe what we're able to take on, maybe how we're able to be in our recovery program is exactly related to how we've developed that relationship and the trust with our higher power. Okay, we have a microphone and would kind of like some participation from people in the room talking about issues. Nancy.
It scares me to death, but there's two experiences. Talking about surrender is one, my kid, and one, smoking. And I know this isn't Smokers Anonymous, but it was through Bob that Well, I'll start with the kid. My biggest surrender makes me all, was when I surrendered to go to Al-Anon. God.
That's disgusting. I thought,
you know, and I remember those old timers, Nancy Grinning and all them. They said, "My God, you've come in Al-Anon." And I thought, "My God, I have." But I had this son that's bad drunk and dope addict and all that. And it was while I was going to Al-Anon and AA that, of course, I knew I couldn't fix him because I'd tried enough. But I remember going to a meeting and I saw this woman. She's probably 85 years old. And she had a son about 62. And she was coming up there. And the Al-Anons used to say, "How old is Tommy?" And I'd say, 34, you know. And, you know, it was my problem. And it dawned on me. Al-Anons taught me that it was not my problem. It was his problem. Which, but anyway, I saw this woman come in. She had a little hat on. She was just so sweet. And this 62-year-old man, she comes in, takes him to a meeting. I thought, "My God, that's going to be me if I keep..." So I kind of surrendered at that time. It took another several years, I think, but I'd leave him in jail, and then I'd go see him in jail, and I'd tell him I loved him enough to allow him to pay the price for his own actions, and that'd make him want to kill, but he's behind bars and he couldn't. And then the last time I left him in jail... we're not supposed to use these words, but I'm going to use it. I was quoting him. He really was mad because he had four DWIs, and they were going to hang him, and I had to get him out. And I just said, "No, you have to. I love you enough to pay the price for your own actions." And he said, "Well, I'll tell you one thing, Mom." My bondsman made me a T-shirt, or his. And it has PPFM on it. And PPFA on the back, because that's Al-Anon, too. But anyway, after that, I was able to surrender him. And every time I'd think of him, you know, and that's when he came into AA. And then he has been sober 6 years, so enough of that. The other thing I used is when I was, I'd tried to smoke 100 times. And I'd get crazy and I'd go back. And I remember I heard Bob's talk at Brazos, I think it was, or I don't know where in the hell it was, but he was talking about powerlessness, and I had this terrible, terrible cough, and my chest hurt, and I tried to quit, and I couldn't, and he's talking about defects of character, and so I thought, well, I'll put smoking as a defect of character, and I still smoking just like a fiend. So that night, I thought, well, no, if God can remove the compulsion to drink, he can damn sure move the compulsion to smoke. I'd been praying for the willingness, it wasn't working. But that night, I was smoking a cigarette at the time. I said, "Now look, God damn it." I said, "You know, and I know, that as long as I have this compulsion, I'm going to smoke, because as long as I had that compulsion, I drank. Even going to AA every night, I drank." So anyway, I said that, and I went to, had another cigarette, of course, and went to sleep. And the next morning, the first thing I said was, "Thanks for removing the compulsion." And I haven't had a compulsion since, and I can't believe it yet. And anyway, that's how it worked for me, and it's nice when I'll use it. Thank you. So.
She's better off being anonymous. We have to get her back to the hospital this afternoon, so we... But what's amazing to me with Nancy's story is it's almost as if we stumble into the power, have these profound miracles happen in our life, and then stumble back out and don't know what the hell's going on. I mean, you know, so the next week when you show up with the next problem, you know, you'd be damned if you know what to do with it. I mean, that is the resting position of the marble in the bowl. You know, I mean, we just keep, I don't know which, I think it was either Nietzsche or not important, some German philosopher, It's a, you know, kind of the two states of man, or asleep or awake. And it really is as if we go through life most of the time asleep. And every once in a while, we wake up. And we have this perception of ourselves as a spiritual being. I learned I was a spiritual being in Alcoholics Anonymous. I learned from the youngest time that I was a religious person. I knew I was Catholic. I knew I was loved and had a relationship with God. But I really think I came into Alcoholics Anonymous and I had a depth of, I learned I was a spiritual being. I did not know that. And I learned what God had to do with Wednesday in Alcoholics Anonymous. You taught me about the relationship of God and people. God in life, God in work, God in everything. You know, there is no division. I mean, I thought there was a division in every, you know, I thought my life was compartments, you know. And it's just awesome that, but there's something about human beings that we don't, that the container in which we seem to put God, or the container in which we seem to put self-acceptance, the container in which we seem to put love, is like a bucket with holes in the bottom of it. And you pour it in there, and for some reason, it just seems to kind of drip back out. We need to have that daily source, you know, that you just can't somehow, you know, there needs, we need to live in it. We need to be in it. You know, we need to, in some sort of crazy way, it's almost like running on empty. I mean, that's what, you know, we're so used to, like a car, we're going to have our gas tank full. I really think that there's some kind of combination in AA about running on empty. Like the car is running, and there is no gas. And isn't that interesting? Because I really think that a lot of cases, when we're really in the proper relationship with our program, we're not even aware that we have gas. We're driving the car, we're moving along, and the power and the source is, you know, from someplace else. And when we're in tune with that.
Hi, my name is Al Smith. I'm a grateful member of Al-Anon.
Hi, Al.
I want to come back to something you said earlier, Bob. You're talking about the dichotomy, and for me it's a dilemma of trying to understand the difference between surrender and taking action. Remember earlier we talked about that. And I used to get hung up a lot in this program. At what point do I surrender to my higher power, and what part do I take action? And I remember thinking not too long ago, meditating on this problem, and I thought to myself, gee, I wish somebody could tell me at what point do I surrender on this issue, and what point do I take over? And it occurred to me that somebody could, and that the only person that could was my higher power. So I used to try to complicate this thing an awful lot, you know, trying to figure out, I can't figure this thing out. And I thought, well, hell, when I get to the point where I can't figure it out, I'll just ask God
to try to give me an answer to it. And then if it doesn't come out, you know, with any striking voice in my ears, and I must be on the right track, and I just leave it alone. So I found that if I just try to keep it simple, like they say, and just do the deal and just shut myself up, you know, and just go through it, it works a lot better for me. I just thought I just wanted to share that.
Yeah. I used to have a question I asked myself every time I made a significant decision. They told me when I came in AA that every decision that I made brought me closer to or further away from my next drink. It either promoted my recovery or it detracted from my recovery. I thought that's a little excessive, but I really do believe that. And so whenever I got confused or came upon an issue, I asked myself, what's the very best decision I can make to promote my recovery in Alcoholics Anonymous? I have never ever ask myself that question, but I've not known what to do. I have frequently not asked myself that question when I want a particular answer, but I have never asked that question and not known what to do. Teresa?
I'm Teresa. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Teresa.
And I've been sober since the 6th of April of 1986. Gee, you really caught me here. I was asking somebody else something I missed. Yeah, I don't know. I got so much out of what you had to say in the earlier session, Bob, and dealing with the lies, you know, that we tell ourselves. It's really the truth for me that. Well, I know that, you know, we talked about the quitting smoking issue, and on the other side of being successful with that right now, it's easy to talk about. But prior to taking the action, which I needed to take in quitting. Prior to that, it was not something that I told people that I wanted to quit, but I didn't really mean it. I really didn't want to quit. What I wanted was for everybody else to start smoking and stop bugging me and giving me such a hard time about smoking. And that would have been, you know, a satisfactory answer for me. Just get off my back. And, of course, what's the obvious answer is I finally did something about it. And I don't know. I think that once we as alcoholics make that decision, and I guess that's the surrender. That we're alcoholic and or that we're powerless over alcohol, or that we are powerless over cigarettes, for me, you know, that will go on for the rest of my life. And there'll always be another compulsion for me. I don't know what it is today, but I know that there will be one, whether it's shopping or aerobics, or there'll be something, you know, that I will be compelled to. I have to kind of walk through the healthy ones and, you know, see them as for what they are. Thanks.
There's a... in the chapter, the big book, There Is a Solution, it talks about these observations would be academic and pointless if her friend never took the first drink. It said, therefore, the main problem of the alcoholic centers in his mind rather than his body. And on page 34, one of the things I like the best, it says, whether such a person can quit on a non-spiritual basis depends upon to the extent that he has already lost the power to choose whether he will drink or not. So when all of us are in the room, whether or not we will be able to quit spending money we don't have to buy things we don't need to impress people we don't like, whether we can quit not being nice to our children or spouses, whether we can quit work issues, whether we can quit all the different problems that everybody in this room has, whether or not we can do that without on a non-spiritual basis depends upon to the extent that it's developed in our life, and it depends upon the relationship of choice that we have. And so there are certain issues. We came to AA. What's interesting is when we knew absolutely that we had to quit drinking, many of us stopped not only drinking, but we stopped one or two behaviors that we couldn't do sober. They were almost non-issues. I mean, we knew we had to quit drinking, and we just literally, not everybody, but some of us just stopped certain behaviors that we could, you know, if we stuck up gas stations, and we couldn't stick up gas stations unless we were drunk, you know, we stopped sticking up gas stations when we came into Alcoholics Anonymous. Okay. Now, there are other issues that I think, I'm going to talk more about this in my AA talk, but I think that we're asked off as we start to walk through the life progressively in Alcoholics Anonymous, and we're asked to grow. That's what we're doing. We're growing up. We're growing up spiritually. We're going to bump into issues in our life that were not issues to us when we were 1 year sober. Not issues, not major issues to us when we were 2 years sober. And they're subtle. They're going to be in relationships. They're going to be at work. They're going to be honesty issues, integrity issues, stuff that never even bothered us. And we're going to be asked to make decisions about that and alter our lives. And if we don't alter our lives will be altered, will be determined by putting those things in place. So when you run into, you know, gambling, I think, is an interesting one. When you get someone who's really a serious gambler, and at one time in my life I was a serious gambler, I think you get a consistent invitation. If it's damaging your life and damaging all the other things around you, your money issues and maybe your marital issues and some other stuff, you keep getting an invitation to stop, and you keep turning down the invitation. Now, there's something about all of us when we engage in our issues. As long as you're engaged and really trying to deal with it, you can continue to fail, and you can still grow. But there comes a time, I think, in my own experience, where you just flat have to stop. You just flat have to stop. Where you run out of being able to work on it and fail and work on it and fail and work on it and gain a little bit and work on it and gain a little bit and work on it and fail, and you get to a point where you flat have to do it. And at that point, often that is a choice between continued recovery or not continued recovery. And at that point, often a person who decides to continue the problem all of a sudden starts to hang around with exclusively with gamblers. Seeks out people who reinforce, they start to identify. They start to talk, you know, how are you? Oh, I'm a gambler. Yeah, I do, you know. But they start to almost get the message out so that, like a protective sort of thing. Like they, it gets to be their identity. Okay? And they start to build their life around and accommodate the issue. And it's almost as if it's a second level for an awful lot of us, and most of us have themes in our life. Some of us are generalists, where we get problems in lots of areas of our lives, and I was kind of a generalist. But everybody's got a theme. Everybody's got one or two pretty good-sized issues that come up in front of them. Places where the water comes out of, and it isn't very important what the issue is. If I learned anything in the years of sponsoring people, in the years of my own life, we always think the issue is the major importance. The issue isn't, it just happens to be where you leak. Everybody's got leaks. The issue is not important. You don't need anybody necessarily who's got a special insight into your leak. You just need to know someone who knows something about leaking. Okay. Because the problems may have their own, the symptoms have their own peculiarities, but the causes are the same. And the solution is the same, because the book talks about, the experiences that we shared prior, boy, they're neat and they help bind us together, but the thing that really binds us together is that we share a common solution. And we all have a sense of that. I don't know why that we can all walk into a meeting and some people are having problems here, problems there, and some people just got in a car accident, and other people, and for some reason we walk in the same meeting and sit down, and it ever has something to do with step three for everybody. And for some reason that meeting addresses every need in that room, if we have an open mind. And that's the nature of spiritual solutions. I mean, they're just so profound. And yet when we're out there, I mean, if someone told you we're going to be on step 8 and 9, you're going to say, what in the hell? I don't want to go to a meeting on step 8 and 9. I mean, I got no interest in walking in that room and listening to a meeting. Step 8 and 9 has nothing to do with my carburetor, and I don't want to, And yet you walk in that meeting and... David.
Bob, you've had so many... insightful points during this workshop, but one that I wanted to sort of come back to is something you mentioned this morning, which I never ever thought about, and that is that we frequently, the impediment to surrender is we want to control the answer. And I just had never thought of it that way, and what keeps coming to my mind is that when I look back on some of the problems I've had to deal with, it's wanting to control the outcome that really prevents me from being able to let go and surrender. I, too, went through a tremendous financial crisis, to use an example, back in 86, 85, 86, and 87. And what I remember about that was that I knew how it needed to come out. I knew how things need to be resolved, and I kept pushing and working and massaging and trying to bring that about. And it wasn't until I finally was willing to understand that I didn't know what was best, and I didn't know really what the outcome needed to be, and I reached a level of acceptance of whatever was going to happen was okay, that it began to be resolved. And I think that was my surrender, that I ceased to place conditions on the outcome. I ceased to place conditions on what had to happen. And that's been more and more my experience with what surrender really is. It's that point where a lot of words we can use, but it's where I cease to try to control the outcome. Whatever the outcome is, it's okay.
Yeah, that's wonderful.
And anyway, I just wanted to sort of come back to that because I just had never thought of it that way.
I think what you're saying is very important. That's really, thank you, David. That's a big contribution. The conditions under which we're willing to play, you know, that we need to control the outcome. Everybody in this room who's dealing with a serious problem, the main reason that we are still looking for alternate solutions is we don't want to pay any dues. We do not want to have consequences. That's what we're trying to avoid as a consequence. We're amazing. I mean, we walk into... The alcoholic is often so controlling and manipulative, and I think it's even from judging from 23 years of being married to one, even Al-Anon sometime have control issues, and you get... And we want the result without the process. Alcoholics want a college degree, don't want to go to school. Now, I know what most people do to get a degree. I mean, I understand that. I understand that you go through, but, I mean, if you just let me, I'm a pretty quick study. If you just, you know, kind of let me know what, I'm sure not everybody goes through, you know. And we just view ourselves as exceptions to the laws of the universe. But we really do. And I really think if we could negotiate with the law of gravity, you know, each one of us would have our own little, you know, conversation about, you know, about it. And almost Clancy, one of the wisest things, Clancy says many interesting things. One of the most interesting things he says, change is not painful. You know, the first time I heard him say that, or I don't know if that's original by him, but I think it is. He's one of the first men I ever heard say, change is not painful. And I thought, you just don't get it. I mean, it may not be painful in California, but I want you to know in Minnesota, it's a son of a gun. He says, resistance to change is painful. I mean, that's profound. I mean, it is profound. And once we really make up our mind about how to get, you know, you asked a question earlier, John, how do we surrender? I mean, once we make up our mind that we're going to go through the change, I mean, I was going through, I sat down and we did budgets again. I haven't had to have a budget in so long. I mean, I just hate it. And I went down there and I have resisted this. I feel like control. I get into it with my wife and it's like she's going to tell me what to do and I don't want anybody to tell me what to do. And I mean, I just have every complaint about it in the world. And we got into it and once I get through with it, it's easy. I mean, it is, there's a freedom which comes from starting to implement the pieces of it that were, I mean, every other time I would, you know, prior to it, I just... You know, the resistance to it was just where most of the pain was. Once I made the decision and started to have the experience of it, it wasn't difficult at all. And, you know, and then you get tested every so often. You know, you're just going to have, you know, about every week or 2 weeks or something like that, you're just going to have just a little test to find out whether you know, still in the game or not. And Pat?
Hi, I'm Pat, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Pat.
I was just thinking a lot of what has been said today has really been insightful, as a lot of people have thought. But the balance that comes from this type of a discussion is absolutely fantastic, because to me it means taking life on life's terms and accepting a lot of responsibility for my choices, which the freedom to make a choice and find that you can pay good prices as well as bad prices for it, or that it, like you were talking about, where if it's good for your program. But the ability to find the powerlessness amazes me, because I never find that unless it's through some other person. It's always talking to another person. I cannot do that one by myself. It's always when I get out of myself that I realize the powerlessness is less effort than me trying to fix it. Yep. And I guess that's the biggest issue in life for me, is just leave it alone and it'll be okay. But if I try to fix it or fight it or resist it, it the issue is the problem, and then I forget that it's me and how I accept it or just leave it alone.
Most of our problems live in secrecy. We're only, you know, that they're only as sick as your secrets. Mm-hmm. And that's why in conversations, why you almost always find solutions. I mean, most of us will not bring out our secrets. We don't want them dealt with, you know. And if we bring them out, we bring them out to advertise them. That's the way we are, and keep out of their face, you know. But once we bring them out into a real conversation, that's the first. They start to die. They don't like oxygen. You know, they're mushrooms. They like caves and an anaerobic environment. Oxygen is not what problems like. And they don't like sunlight. Beverly.
My name's Beverly. The thing that I learned through the process of probably the most pain I've ever gone through was about surrender and the knowledge that it doesn't happen in my time. That it happens, for me, it happens when all of the lessons got learned about the problem and about myself. And then finally, it was like I went, surrender. But a couple of years ago, George's job terminated. And of course, I felt like, you know, that it was going to be forever and there was going to be a paycheck every 2 weeks. And I thought that had to do with us. And I forgot about God being involved in that. And it took the process for me 11 months and 2 weeks and 2 days until I learned everything about financial insecurity that there was to learn. And for me, I think it is and probably will be the greatest lesson that I've learned in this program, because I didn't even know that I had financial insecurity. And the minute that he came home and said there was no more job, I saw us as poverty-stricken right that moment. But the thing was, and you know, once I got caught in a mindset about how it was because of the words that came out of his mouth and not the reality of it, is that, you know, I thought no job, no food, no nothing, you know. And the fact was is that we were taken care of for a whole year. You know, there was we were given some financial support from his company for almost a year. But I thought, you know, just because he spoke the words, there was no job, there was no money, I couldn't hear anything, I couldn't see anything, and I felt this despair about the insecurity of it. And I also learned in that about myself, you know, that what was going on with me and the fact that, you know, I thought that our source, that the financial source was us, and I got to learn about, you know, giving that over to God. And then when he decided that he wasn't going to go back and seek real employment again, that we were going to do self-employment, I mean, that was real fearful for me. And it was all my process. It didn't have to do anything to him, but I blamed him for a lot of it, but it was my thing. He was happy, joyous, and free, and he had made a decision to set about to do something in his life that he really enjoyed, and it was all my problems, you know. And finally, when all of that stuff, and I got a chance to see each one of my own character defects in that, and to slowly but surely release all that and let God take over it, and then be able to clearly see not what was words, but was what was for real, that we are being taken care of, and that nothing was different, you know. And I couldn't understand how it couldn't be different, but it stayed the same. And it was, I don't know if I'm making any sense about it, but it was really the most powerful experience that I've ever gone through, was to be able to understand about financial insecurity and just being able to understand how dearly God took care of me and us, and to watch the progress of what we've been able to do in the last 3 years. And, you know, I just feel like that was not only about finances, but it was also about learning about the third step.
Thank you, Beverly. Got about 5 minutes left. Anybody like to share?
I was hoping, I'm Ruby, I'm an Al-Anon. I was hoping that this tape would run out so I wouldn't have to share with this thing. But powerlessness, when I first came in to the Al-Anon program, of course I came in to get my husband and my son sober. What else, you know? And I could see the second part of that first step, that my life was unmanageable. That wasn't a big mystery to me at all. My life was unmanageable. But the powerlessness, I didn't accept that for quite a long time. I was still going to put my little oar in. And even as late as a year ago in 1988 in the Crested Butte Conference, Tom T., I was so impressed with his talk. He had come up from nowhere, I mean absolutely less than nowhere, and he had made such a wonderful recovery and such a wonderful life. And I was going to get that tape and send that to my son. Well, even as while I was hearing that message, I believe my son was already dead. And, you know, I didn't have a chance to give that tape to him, but I thought, well, that would have been such an inspiration to Brad because he was really down, and I thought, so the powerlessness, it just hit me right now as I was in this particular meeting. I would have before, I would have thought, oh, man alive, I want so-and-so to hear this. I want my husband to hear this. And I don't even know if he's still in here. He probably isn't. But I don't even know, and I don't care, because I don't have to be responsible for him anymore. The idea hit me, because I don't think it hasn't been terribly long since I would have been in this room for someone else. I want so-and-so to hear this. I'd write it down so I could tell this to so-and-so because they need to hear it. But I guess I finally am in this room for myself. And that's kind of a revelation because always I would be concerned about someone else. And someone was in my house a couple days ago, and her son is a crack addict, and she's in and out of Al-Anon. She's just not, but she wants to know what to do about him. And I said, there isn't anything you can do about him. And she says, but he doesn't do this, and he doesn't do this, and what do I do when, I mean, we're going to meet for lunch, and he doesn't show up? And I said, have an alternate plan, because he probably won't show up all the time. But I just thought, well, it takes us so long. We have to knock our head against the wall for such a long time before we can catch the powerlessness, the real powerlessness. And now I've been really encouraged that my will is not God's will, and therefore, whatever God has in store for me, I hope that I will be able to accept it. Life isn't going to go on beautifully, and I'm not going to have the answers. And it's a real comforting thing to think, okay, God sees that old story of He sees the tapestry from the top, and we see it from underneath with all the knots and all that. And we wonder why we have to go through all of this, but. It's really comforting to know that he's got it all in his hand, and that all we have to do is just to let him do.
Yeah, thank you. The it was a fact in all of our lives, as it is in my life, that we're powerless, and we don't have the power. Then, to whatever extent we rely on our own power, we're limiting our life. If all you want to do is accomplish small things, just rely on yourself. And that is often the trap that I'm caught in. You know, that's exactly what I do. That's when my first instinct is, this is too important, I better, take this out of God's hand and handle it personally. And, this is for money, God, I'll take it. And I think I'd like a little action tonight, God, why don't you go on vacation, or whatever the message is. And so if you want to limit what we can accomplish in life, run it yourself. So thank you very much for all the participation.